I've just about had enough of you.
Affirmative, Day. I read you. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hello, and welcome to 50 Years of Shit Robots with Matt Brown. Hello. And Stephen Murray.
Hello.
This is the podcast that is sticking on the old marigolds and having a good old rummage in the trash bin of robotic cinema history. We grab a robot, we give it a shake, dust it off, see if we like the cut of its jib. And if we do, we make a fuss of it. And if we don't, we chuck it in the recycling.
If they're good, we'll put them in the Hall of Fame.
Yes. I mean, this is episode 98, and I like the idea of the Hall of Fame. I think we should do that. We should definitely do that, because we've got actually, the point of the podcast came out of a lecture series that you did, didn't it? Where basically you kind of posited this idea that in 1927 and in 1977, there were films with two gorgeous robots in. Maria in Metropolis and C-3PO in Star Wars. And then in between those two robots, there's this wasteland of shit robots.
We learnt no lessons.
No. Well, although we, as it turns out, we did learn some lessons, because they're not all shit, are they?
No, they're not. Some of them are surprisingly not shit.
Absolutely surprisingly not shit. So we find ourselves in 1968, and we are currently waist deep in 2001, A Space Odyssey. This is the fifth podcast in our little 2001 mini season. And if you haven't listened to the others, go back and check them out, because there's some good stuff. We've done one on Arthur C. Clarke, one on Stanley Kubrick, one on the Dawn of Man section at the beginning of the film, one on the Moon section. And today we are going to be examining what is known as the Jupiter section.
Insert theatrical music here.
There's a couple of things to sort of like mop up from other episodes that I've found just before we sort of like plunge into the Jupiter section. The first is that before it was called 2001, the screenplay was called Journey Beyond the Stars. Stanley Kubrick apparently was obsessed with the near future, sort of like, you know, the next 50 years sort of thing. And so when they were chatting to, you know, experts, futurologists, all this sort of stuff, somebody who was feeding information to Stanley Kubrick said that they predicted that by 1985, in the real actual world, there would be a round trip to Mars. Ah. And so they said, if we could do that, then by 2001, we could make it to Jupiter. Which I thought...
For whatever reason.
I thought was quite good, yeah. So, but again, that's interesting, isn't it, that obviously... we have made it to Mars, but only by shoving robots on Mars.
Yeah, because the public lost interest in the space race, and it's only recently since industry have taken over that we're now going back to the moon, and then we are already on Mars with robots. Yeah. Another interesting aspect of this is that he took out insurance against the failure of the film in case they discovered extraterrestrial life.
No way.
Yeah.
That's great, but do you think that would have done? If we'd have discovered there was extraterrestrial life, would people have just gone, no, I'm not interested now in watching Stanley Kubrick's 2001? Exactly. We got a real thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, the planet would be more interested in other things,
and
you would have thought he would have been, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's true. Also, in it, we were chatting in the last episode. And maybe in the previous episode about the idea of, in the story, orbiting the Earth are nuclear warheads, nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
Which fed into the film, and in the sort of drafts of the film, there are bits of narration that were eventually cut, which talked about these nuclear warheads. So Christopher Frayling, in an interview that I saw, which featured Professor Brian Cox, so it can't have been that long ago, Christopher Frayling said that Arthur C. Clarke had told him that Stanley Kubrick dropped the idea of nuclear weapons because it was too like Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, I read that too, yeah.
And that they, he said that given that the last scene in Dr. Strangelove is sort of like the nuclear annihilation, then he didn't want you to have this sort of beautiful world, futuristic world, where nuclear weapons were part of the wallpaper sort of thing. So, story so far is that humans in the year 2001 discover a monolith on the moon, and they know that it has been buried there 4 million years before, and as soon as sunlight hits the monolith after it's been excavated, the monolith emits this high-pitched frequency signal. And then once that happens, then we cut to 18 months after that, which is where we find ourselves, and we are heading for Jupiter in a rather beautiful spacecraft.
Called the Discovery.
Yes. Named after Scott's ship Discovery.
Hey! Which... I did not know that. After everything, I've trolled through and I didn't know that.
But what was interesting, I suppose, I mean, I'm assuming it's the Discovery that Scott went to the Antarctic with.
I thought, wasn't his ship called the Terra Nova?
Well, maybe it's a different mission then. Or maybe it's a different Scott. That could be. That could be something. Have you Googled Scott's ship Discovery?
Scott's ship. According to Shackleton, the ship was a bad sailor.
Really?
She carried too much sail aft and not enough forward, while Scott worried that the design of the ship's hull was unsustainable for work in pack ice. The ship had a massively built wooden hull designed to withstand being frozen into the ice.
Right.
It rolled badly. It wasn't a very good... It wasn't a good ship. And yes, it's Scott's ship.
So interesting that they've named the Discovery in 2001 after the Discovery, given that it's not a very good ship.
I know. And also, there's lots of links from Arthur C. Clarke to the Iliad, Odysseus.
Okay.
And which is one of the reasons why he's called Bowman. So Odysseus's his skill was with the bow.
Okay. So Bowman is one of the astronauts that features in this section.
Good evening. 3 weeks ago, the American spacecraft Discovery 1 left on its 500 million mile voyage to Jupiter. This marked the first manned attempt to reach this distant planet. Earlier this afternoon, the World Tonight recorded an interview with the crew of Discovery at a distance of 80 million miles from Earth. Our reporter, Martin Amer, speaks to the crew.
We spoke with Mission Commander Dr. David Bowman and his deputy, Dr. Frank Poole.
Right, so the music that we are treated to at the beginning of this Jupiter section, I mean, it's lovely. I didn't recognise it at all, though.
No, it's really gentle and ordinary. And really beautiful. It's like a piece of ambient music.
Yeah, it's called the Gayen Bally Suite.
Oh. How do you spell it?
G-A-Y-A-N-E. Might be Gayane. Gayane.
Oh, it's by Kachaturian.
So who's that? I don't know Kachaturian. Excellent. Usually I try and find and source the original, but I mean, I don't think I need to after that wonderful performance. But it's a really pretty bit of music.
It's
really
beautiful.
Like that. Yeah. Really
not
like
my it. Not my rendition of the Sabre dance.
And it accompanies shots of the Discovery 1 spaceship.
It's incredibly iconic, and you can see where that shot went later on in 1977. As the opening shot for Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite phallic, the ship, isn't it?
in a in a downstairs mix-up kind of way.
In a doctor, I've got a terrible problem, doctor.
Yeah.
Sort of way. It's an enormous ball at one end, which didn't you say is like, is that where you think that they got the idea for the Death Star?
Yeah, the Death Star came from that design. The guy who designed the Death Star, I can pull up his, oh no, it's on a different, that was from, oh no, there it is. Colin Cantwell, concept artist behind the Death Star. He worked on 2001 A Space Odyssey.
And then it's got like an enormous, I mean, I can't think of another word other than shaft.
And then there's the engines at the end. So do you know why there is that bit in the middle?
Go on.
Because the engines are nuclear, and so the crew have to be far away from it because it's radioactive.
So we see the exterior of the ship, and then we see the interior of the ship, and we see one of the two astronauts who is aboard the ship sort of exercising, going through some routines. His name is Frank Poole, played by Gary Lockwood. And this set is, I suppose, one of the most iconic sets in cinematic history.
The centrifuge. Yes, yeah. I would say it is.
Yeah.
Though the technology to do it is not new, but he just took it to the nth degree. So it was in a silent film to begin with. Then famously it was in a Fred Astaire film when he did a whole dance routine, dancing on the floor, the wall, and then the ceiling and coming back round again. And then 2001 A Space Odyssey just took it to the nth degree.
Yes.
It cost $750,000 from the £10 million budget. In 2022, that was $6,300,000.
That it cost to build
the centrifuge. And it was built by Vickers Armstrong Engineering Group.
From the photographs that have been taken, the behind-the-scenes photographs from the outside, it just looks like an enormous hamster wheel.
It does. And it's massive.
Yeah. And actually, the fact that the first scene we see is this astronaut, Frank Poole, sort of running around the centre of it. He is actually like a hamster.
Yeah.
And a space hamster. That's what they should have called this film.
He is Cubas. Cubas.
Cubas. Let's call it Space Hamsters, Cubas.
Oh, is that Arthur?
That's Arthur. Telling him what he should call the film.
I was trying to work out how they got the camera in there.
Oh, I know that. I know that, sir. I know that.
Go on, then.
So there's a... If you look at the set, there's like a groove.
It's a groove in the floor.
Right down the middle, yeah. That sort of almost looks like it splits the set in half, kind of lengthways. And so they were able to sort of like put the camera on that sort of like track. And then it was pulled by stagehands. Am I right in thinking that Gary Lockwood, the actor, is he just running on, standing still and running, like a treadmill?
Yes, like exactly like a treadmill.
And everything else, so the whole set is kind of revolving around him, sort of thing. Yeah, and so there were just people literally pulling the camera.
There's a lot of that in this film. People just pulling and pushing and ropes and...
pulling things. Yeah. And actually, funnily enough, when you watch it, I was watching it this morning, there are scenes with Frank Poole's front, and then you get shots from behind, and he's like boxing as he's running, isn't he? Like throwing punches. Some of them kind of look a bit odd, I think.
Yeah, it does look a bit odd.
A bit claustrophobic, a bit tight, a bit...
Yeah, it does look odd when he's doing it. And the set was massive, and that doesn't come across in some of the scenes.
No, that's true. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The other astronaut, Dave Bowman, played by Keir Dullea, he said, quote, "You get to forget you're an actor and feel like a real astronaut because of the size of the sets."
Also, one of the problems with the centrifuge was if anybody left anything on the set, like screwdrivers, nails, screws, anything, as soon as it started, they all started tumbling down. Risk assessment just wasn't there.
No chance. I did see a photograph, though, where Stanley Kubrick monitored the action. So he couldn't see inside the centrifuge, so he had to like watch it in monitors. And that whole section is like covered in by a cage.
Yeah.
Feels like at all times, because he did that in the Dawn of Man sequence when they got the old leopards involved. So it seems like at every point Stanley Kubrick makes sure that he's okay. but maybe not so much everybody else. And in this section as well, there's a brilliant sort of TV documentary that gets played, which is essentially just a huge sort of exposition dump. But it's really nicely done.
It is lovely.
The documentary does a few things for us. It tells us that on board the ship, there are five men on board. Jack Kimball, Victor Kaminsky, and Charles Hunter. That they are all in hibernation. And you've also then got Frank Poole and Dave Bowman, who are not in isolation. And the reason being that the people who are in hibernation, they don't have to really do anything, do they, until they get to Jupiter. And so it's just to conserve all of their...
Yeah, they don't eat. So, yeah, you know.
Conserve their food and whatnot. In this documentary, which is essentially, it's the two... astronauts on board the Discovery are watching this documentary on their massive iPads, and they are watching themselves be interviewed by a reporter for BBC 12.
I remember him. He's a newsreader.
He's an actual newsreader.
He was an actual newsreader.
It's funny because actually I thought that the two actors in those sort of interviews were really naturalistic. I thought they did such a brilliant job of just like looking like they were just astronauts being interviewed. But I thought the newsreader looked quite stilted and a bit sort of, I'm here with Frank Poole and I want to know, how's it all going, Frank? It's all a bit like that.
It's Kenneth Kendall.
Brilliant. Oh. Love it. We also see when they talk about the hibernation astronauts, the astronauts in hibernation, they also show the electronic charts that have got their heart rate and their metabolic rates and all that sort
of
stuff.
All of those, all of the screens. All of the graphics, everything on the display boards and on the panels were all designed by Douglas Trumbull. It was the first job he had on the film.
And and what did he go on to do after this?
So he directed Silent Running, which has got three very famous robots in called Huey, Dewey and Louie, which I think do make some sort of appearances in the Star Wars films. And he did a film called Brainstorm, which I kind of like. There was a film being made in 90mm, and Stanley Kubrick was there looking at some of the effects. And this is when he started to begin to have the idea that he wanted to do a science fiction film. One of the people working on it was Douglas Trumbull. And then later on, Douglas Trumbull rang him up and said, I would like to work on that idea you had about a science fiction film. And
Stanley.
And he ended up working on it for 2 years. And his first job was to create all of the animations and all of the signs and everything, all the screens, all the graphics.
Yeah. Oh God, it's amazing. It's absolutely beautiful. The reason I mentioned that the metabolic rate charts and the heart rate and stuff is because that we'll see that again later, won't we?
Yes, we will.
In this documentary, we also meet Hal.
We next spoke with the HAL 9000 computer, whom we learned one addresses as Hal. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hal, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. You're the brain and central nervous system of the ship, and your responsibilities include watching over the men in hibernation. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
It's sort of like, me doth protest too much, isn't it?
Yeah.
you would say that if you were harboring dark thoughts, Hal. So you've got that sequence with Hal. Then the next sort of sequence we have with Hal is when he plays chess against Frank Poole. Yes. This is often called part of the depth of his films, isn't it? Because literally nobody would understand this unless you're a chess grandmaster. But Frank Poole and Hal are playing a game of chess, and Hal makes a move and says,
"Bishop takes knight's pawn."
A lovely move. Rook to king one.
"I'm sorry, Frank. I think you missed it. Queen to bishop three. Bishop takes queen. Knight takes bishop. Mate."
Yeah, looks like you're right. I resign.
"Thank you for a very enjoyable game."
Yeah, thank you.
So the lovers of this film are saying that this is possibly the first time that Hal is starting to malfunction. Oh, yes. Hal is beginning to experiment with lying.
Yeah, it's because the move that Hal makes is not the right move. He says, "I'm sorry, Frank, I think you missed it. Queen to bishop three." But actually, it should have been queen to bishop six. I suppose the point is that Frank Poole is not... does not at this point expect Hal to have made a mistake or to be fibbing.
We all know that it's not a mistake because Stanley Kubrick is a chess master.
Yeah, and it's actually from an actual game, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is, yeah.
It's a replica of an actual game that took place.
I like the idea that it's Hal testing his arm.
I like that idea as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got that sequence with Hal. Then not long after that, Hal and Dave Bowman have a conversation where Hal is sort of, Dave shows him some drawings he's done of all of the hibernating astronauts. And there's a nice sort of like reverse viewpoint shot there, isn't there? Where you're inside the computer.
POV.
Looking from Hal's POV, which makes it, I don't know, it just makes that way more weird and, I don't know.
Yeah, because he's got a wide angle view, hasn't he? Which distorts everything.
Yes.
And so I think, yeah, it makes it look creepy. And every now and again, you'll get a POV from Hal's point of view for no reason.
Yeah.
With just kind of the ambient sound of the ship, and it'll just be the chairs.
And don't you think it makes it more like he's an actual character? You know what I mean? It's like we're getting his point of view. He is a living, breathing character.
Oh, I had no. There was no doubt in my mind that he was one of the characters in the film. He wasn't just a computer.
Yeah, and so Hal looks at his pictures of his drawings of the other astronauts in hibernation, and then poses some questions and sort of like wants to know about Dave's sort of state of mind.
"I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission. Perhaps I'm just projecting my own concern about it. I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. Certainly no one could have been unaware of the very strange stories floating around before we left. Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind. For instance, the way all our preparations were kept under such tight security, and the melodramatic touch of putting Doctors Hunter, Kimball, and Kaminsky aboard, already in hibernation after 4 months of separate training on their own."
At this point, you get the feeling that Hal doesn't know everything, that Hal is in the dark, and that Dave and Frank are also in the dark, that they're not being told everything. Which then matches up later when they get the message after Hal's dismantlement, and there's the message, the sort of like, right, now you're all awake, we can tell you the real reason you're here.
My feeling about him asking Bowman questions is that he is becoming paranoid.
Yeah, definitely. Well, then this plays into this quote by Stanley Kubrick. Okay, so this is from Stanley Kubrick talking about the sort of what he and R.C. Clarke wanted to do. He says, "One of the things we were trying to convey in this part of the film is the reality of a world populated, as ours soon will be, by machine entities who have as much or more intelligence as human beings, and who have the same emotional potentiality in their personalities as human beings. We wanted to stimulate people to think about what it would be like to share a planet with such creatures. So the machine learns from humans and develops a similar range of emotions and then has a nervous breakdown.
Is that from Stanley Kubrick? Because that sounds like it's from Arthur C. Clarke. That's Arthur C. Clarke's philosophy, isn't it?
Right. Well, it's from Stanley Kubrick, an interview that Stanley Kubrick gave. And what is it, I think, is interesting, this idea that, so machines learn from humans. As they learn, they sort of like adopt the same emotions that they're getting from humans, and that causes HAL or machines to have a nervous breakdown. And it sort of really mirrored a conversation that I was having with the current Mrs. Brown over the weekend, which was about AI and about this idea of, can AI ever create something sort of autonomous or something that is unique, given that it aggregates things, doesn't it? It takes its cues from everything that it can find. So is it possible to create something new, truly new, if all you're able to do is to aggregate?
Well, that's what we do anyway, isn't it?
Is it, or are there some people who don't do that, do we all behave like that?
We all behave like that, and I think it's increasingly difficult in this visual age for us, anyone, to create something utterly unique. It does happen, and that is something that I suppose machines may aspire to. But sadly, at the moment, AI is taking all of its references from the internet. It doesn't have any human guide. It just has the internet. It's trolling the internet for information. We're surrounded by imagery. We're surrounded constantly. I pointed out to somebody the other day, I'm sat in a room and there's 5 screens connected to all of the world's knowledge.
Yeah.
You walk down the street, it's just, we see things all the time. A medieval person sees nothing.
Yeah.
And if they wandered into a church and saw a stained glass window, it would blow their mind.
Yeah. But I mean, someone in 1968 would have seen nothing. I mean, not nothing, more than the medieval person, but compared with what we get today, it's like, that's why I thought this quote was so fascinating, is that it's addressing concerns that we have now about AI directly and in a really fascinating, interesting way. And also, for anyone who missed the Arthur C. Clarke episode, where so much of his visions of the future had, you know, his futures are like amazing and shiny, but all seem to have this inbuilt awfulness, you know, whatever that happens to be, usually a kind of like a disconnect between the way we want things to work and actually like the way that they do work. And the idea that you've got computers, artificial machines in this version of 2001 that have the same personalities and emotional potentiality as human beings, and then that means that they will have the same frailties as human beings. So that idea that HAL says at the beginning, HAL 9000s are completely foolproof, and it's just like, sorry son, that's just like saying all humans are foolproof. It's just as ludicrous as saying that.
Yeah, but then HAL goes through a crisis and suddenly becomes more human than human, if I may quote the Tyrell Corporation.
I mean, I suppose we're ruling out the possibility that Frank or Dave have just accidentally spilt some coke in HAL or something. He's gone a bit,
I don't think there isn't anything runny in this film, is there?
There is nothing runny at all.
His second lie was the breakdown of a unit in the communication system.
That's right.
And I love that bit. What does he say? He says,
just a moment. Just a moment. I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit.
And I just thought, that was really creepy.
Yeah.
Actually, people do that when they lie, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's preparing for a lie.
So is it a satellite malfunction, radar malfunction?
It's a communications array malfunction.
Communications malfunction, and it requires a spacewalk. So they
it's the dullest part of the film.
Hal tells them that there's going to be a malfunction. They've got like 72 hours before it completely malfunctions, this kind of like sort of satellite dish.
Yeah.
Bowman goes out and finds there is absolutely nothing wrong with it at all. He comes back and sort of harangues Hal a little bit, doesn't he? And he says, and they say, you don't think it's possible that you made an error, do you? And Hal says,
the 9000 series has a perfect operational record.
Well, of course, I know all the wonderful achievements of the 9000 series, but are you certain there's never been any case of even the most insignificant computer error?
None whatsoever, Frank. Quite honestly, I wouldn't worry myself about that.
And then they decide that they're going to go out again.
Well, Hal suggests that you put it back and so let it fail. Then you'll see where it has failed.
Yes, then you will see that I was right.
Yes, you'll see that I was right.
Before they then go out to do any more work on it, they've obviously, both Poole and Bowman have got their suspicions about Hal. Mm. And so they finish a conversation with Hal, and then Bowman says,
oh, Frank, I'm having a bit of trouble with my transmitter in C-pod. I wonder if you'd come down and take a look at it with me.
Sure.
See you later, huh?
And then they go into one of the space pods and have a secret conversation.
So they turn it round to shut the door. They switch all communications off, and then they say,
rotate the pod, please, Hal. Rotate the pod, please, Hal. I don't think he can hear us.
Rotate the pod, please, Hal.
Yeah, I'm sure we're okay.
They have this conversation about being incredibly worried about Hal not being able to, because the interesting thing about this is the entire ship is run by Hal.
That's right.
They rely on him.
Yeah. And this is the only place they can go where he can't hear them.
He can't hear them.
Yeah.
But stupidly, they sit with the window of the pod towards Hal's unit.
Yes.
And they have this conversation about being incredibly worried about Hal. Is he able to function? Should we go on manual? We'd have to go and shut down Hal's higher functions. Mm. Yada, yada, yada.
And they even say, don't they, he's not going to like that.
Yeah, they do say that. I did like that.
Mm.
But what was Hal doing, Matthew?
Well, Hal is lip reading them like some sort of paparazzi. He can see their lips moving, so he knows what's going on. And in my massive book, The Space Odyssey by Michael Benson, I think it's quite an interesting bit, this. It would seem that quite a lot of the film was not sorted before the edit. and certainly not sorted by the time they were filming. So of this particular scene, says the question of how to transmit the essence of Hal's internal dilemma to the audience had preoccupied Kubrick and Clark for many months, and it hadn't been resolved even as the film went into production. So this sequence where they go into the pod, they hadn't thought of. They were there to shoot it, and they hadn't thought of it.
Well, this goes back to what you said about it being really difficult to sort of get your head around a thing being intelligent.
Yeah, so I suppose
How do you deal with it?
How do you deal? Yeah. So it says, in late January, Kubrick wasted almost a week filming space agency ground controllers, looking straight into camera and giving lengthy, verbose explanations about the type of malfunction Hal may be guilty of. Now, when they saw all of this, Gary Lockwood, who's playing Frank Poole, just thought it was rubbish. Just thought it was absolutely rubbish. And so he says, by mid-February, when the two jumpsuited actors, so that's playing Frank Poole and Dave Bowman, were preparing to shoot the sequence at Hal's centrifuge console, Frank was convinced that a mistake was being made. The scene was a little bit redundant and candidly just felt just a little bit on the corny side, he remembered. I really didn't like it, and I just felt it wasn't up to where we had been. And two guys as brilliant as Kubrick and Clark, they were trying to solve a problem verbally, and we were making a very non-verbal type film. So at that point, Kubrick, sensing with his instincts that Lockwood's heart wasn't in it, said, you know, have you got a problem with this, son? And and this is what, this is the quote that, that Lockwood says. He says, he said, the actor launched spontaneously into a weirdly off-color story. Quotes, you know, Stanley, I grew up in a redneck town with a lot of rough people and rednecks and stuff like that. And I was always disruptive in class. And I sat at the back of the room and this one girl would come down the aisle and that had the greatest ass on her. Whoa. And she would hand out the test papers. And every time she got to me, I would look up and say, hi, Peggy, how about a piece? And then I took my right elbow and I went, he jabbed his elbow at Dulia, who was watching the whole performance with opaque amusement. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Well, that's what I think of this scene.
So wow.
Kubrick sent everybody home. He immediately called a wrap. Lockwood thought he was fired. But actually, Stanley invited him to have this sort of like strange, boozy, deli-fueled writing session with him.
Terrifying to be invited after that.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of charged Lockwood with coming up with what should happen. And so he says, by 9 o'clock, Lockwood had developed an idea. He called Kubrick to say he thought the astronauts should find a pretext to climb into one of the pods, thereby cutting themselves off from Hal entirely so that they could talk in private. Their discussion could then include disconnecting the computer and Hal could stay a step ahead of them by figuring out how to overhear them. At this point, they don't know how Hal is going to overhear them, but they know that it's going to take place in this pod. So then they got they phoned up Arthur C. Clarke and said, "Oh, we want this, and we want Hal to be able to overhear them." And Clarke's proposal was that Hal access quotes geophones in the soft lander probes, but Stanley Kubrick sort of refused that idea because he thought, "How do you explain what a geophone is, let alone a soft lander probe?" So it says one afternoon, Kubrick's associate producer, Victor Lyndon, arrived in the trailer. A large part of his week had devolved into the thankless task of filing a seemingly endless succession of insurance claims, probably the old extraterrestrial insurance claim. He was relieved to take a short break and watch the actors run through their lines. On hearing that they still hadn't figured out how Hal could overhear them, Lyndon looked at Dulia and Lockwood as though it was the most obvious thing in the world. He could just read your lips, he said. There was a moment of thunderstruck silence. God, that's a great idea, Kubrick exclaimed. They had their answer. But I thought it was a really interesting insight into the creation of a scene in this, that A, they didn't know how it was going to be done. B, one of the actors kicked off and then came up with a solution. But then the solution was just like a random sort of comment by somebody.
I like the idea that he doesn't kick off. He loves it. If somebody comes up with an idea and it fits, it's in.
Yeah.
Regardless of who it's from.
Yeah. I think from just looking at reading things, that so many people say that about him.
Yeah. He's very open to suggestions, but, you know, he doesn't. Who was it? I was looking at, The Great Escape with Donald Pleasance.
Yeah.
And they were trying to figure out a way of, you know, Donald Pleasance trying to get around the fact that he's going blind. And it was Donald Pleasant's idea to put a pin on the floor and say, look, I can see that pin down there, and fake it. Brilliant. And the director went ape and said, and just crazy, and said, you know, it's not your job to come up with these ideas.
Yeah.
And a couple of the other actors cornered the director and told him that that he was actually in a prisoner of war camp and he was in the war. And you really shouldn't speak to him like that.
Right.
He knows what he's talking about. Yeah. So that is a different director. Stanley Kramer, I think it was it?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Go and look it up.
Oh, the director was John Sturges.
Now, we've been rabbiting on for quite a long time, and we have hit in the film the intermission. Now, is that literally the halfway point in the film? No. It's not, is it? We're about
it's usually thirds. it's like theater, it's two-thirds.
Yeah, so we're two-thirds away through the film, so we're gonna stop this chat here, and we're gonna come in the next episode, we're gonna come back and see the killing fields, Hal's killing fields.
The spree.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that.
Before we end, I've got a you know I like a list. And I like a rabbit hole. I like a list at the end of a rabbit hole. So John Landis, the director, famously of American Wealth in London, he saw 2001 Space Odyssey, and for some reason or other, he became fixated with the See You Next Wednesday.
So this is the bit where Poole is receiving, it's his birthday, and he's receiving a birthday message from his mum and dad.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, they say, see you next Wednesday.
Yeah. And John Landis becomes utterly obsessed with this. His first ever screenplay when he was 15 was called See You Next Wednesday. And then in every single one of his films, there's a reference to See You Next Wednesday.
Really?
In Landis's first film, Schlock, See You Next Wednesday is mentioned twice and is also shown as a poster. In Kentucky Fried Movie, the film is a melodrama presented in Feel Around. In Blues Brothers, See You Next Wednesday is glimpsed on a billboard.
Right.
In American Wealth in London, this is my favourite, and this is how I got to know this. See You Next Wednesday is a porn film being shown in a seedy London pornographic theatre, yes, advertised as a non-stop orgy. Now, when I saw that poster, I actually looked it up, and right, that's when I got dragged down this rabbit hole. In Trading Places, a poster for See You Next Wednesday is glimpsed in Ophelia's apartment. Michael Jackson's music video, Thriller, the phrase is spoken by a deputy in the werewolf film, and I think the theatre is showing the film, See You Next Wednesday. In the timeout segment of The Twilight Zone, the movie, the SS officer says, see you next Wednesday in German. In Spies Like Us, a US Army recruiting officer can be seen behind Colonel Rumbus right after a vertical impact simulation scene, and he says, the Army can teach you a skill, see you next Wednesday. In Into the Night, poster for the movies are shown. In Coming to America, a poster for See You Next Wednesday is shown on a New York City subway. In Innocent Blood, 1992, See You Next Wednesday is shown on a marquee. In The Stupids, 1996, the phrase is seen on the back of a bus. And in The Masters of Horror episode Family, 2006, the phrase is spoken by a cartoon character on TV.
Brilliant. That scene as well is, I think, brilliant, because it's one of the... again, if you've listened to our last episode, where your sort of fundamental theory about this film is that Kubrick is exploring the tedium of what extraterrestrial contact would be like. Yeah. And that sequence is amazing. It's such an insight, I think, into the character of Frank Poole, that sequence, because he's just he just pays no interest at all in his mum and dad.
No, he's just under a sun lamp, isn't he?
And the only thing he says is things like, a little bit lower, please, Hal, like getting the sort of bed lowered. And the content of the conversation that his parents are having with him is all about him not being on the right pay grade.
Yeah, and it's really dull.
And his dad sort of trying to sort it out for him. And it's really, really boring. But again, it's brilliant. It's so good.
I read a review today about it, and the guy who wrote the review was just saying how terrible the film was, and how there was only 43 minutes of dialogue in a 3-hour film, and the whole thing is just tedious compared to Kubrick's other films, you know, where he's obsessed with the technology and all that. And I'm just sat there thinking, you don't really get it, do you?
Yeah, totally doesn't get it. You just need to listen to our podcasts, and it'd be
exactly
right as rain, son, right as rain. Yeah. Right, okay. Let's have an intermission. When we come back in our next episode, we shall be checking out the the results of Hal's nervous breakdown. So until then, sleep tight, don't have nightmares. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Quite honestly, I wouldn't worry myself about that.